Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn and Anna Mateo. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
The United Nations is calling for urgent action to protect a whistled language used in a mountainous area of Turkey. The UN's Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, has identified the bird language as an endangered cultural heritage. UNESCO noted that technological developments, as well as social and economic changes, have led to a drop in the number of people who communicate in this way. It also noted a drop in the number of areas where the language is spoken. The UN agency placed much of the blame on the use of mobile phones. A whistled language is a highly developed method of communication. People use whistling sounds in place of words. The language was created as a way to communicate across great distances in difficult mountain conditions. Most whistling sounds are created by blowing air through the lips and teeth. Sometimes fingers and the tongue are also used to make different or louder sounds. To communicate, people use whistling to simulate or create the sound of some words. They also use sound patterns, repeating certain sounds to represent other common words and expressions. New words and terms can be added to keep up with changes in spoken language and cultural life. UNESCO estimates the whistled language is spoken or understood by about 10,000 people in the eastern Black Sea area of northern Turkey. However, only a small number of villagers still use the language. Currently, officials estimate it is mostly only spoken in a small community in Giresun province. UN officials say members of the community consider the practice a major part of their cultural identity. They believe using the language helps strengthen interpersonal communication and solidarity. UNESCO called whistled language an environmentally friendly form of communication. It added, the language can make life easier and reinforce social bonds for the people living in the region. With the new generation's lack of interest in whistled language, there is the risk it will eventually be torn from its natural environment, becoming an artificial practice, UNESCO said. In Turkey, at least one group has been formed to find ways to keep the whistled language strong. The group is working to create a plan for passing the language on to future generations. It will also seek to raise international recognition of the issue. In addition, UNESCO said scientific research will be carried out to support efforts to continue the whistled language. Other areas also have used whistled languages. In 2009, UNESCO expressed concerns about one such language disappearing from Spain's Canary Islands. The language, called Silbo Gomero, was based on Castilian Spanish. It was handed down from one generation to the next over many centuries. UNESCO said it was the only whistled language in the world to be fully developed and practiced in a community of more than 22,000 people. I'm Brian Lynn.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. In winter, people might lessen their outdoor exercise. The days get dark earlier, and it can be very cold. These conditions can make it harder for some of us to get outdoors for exercise. However, cold days can be perfect for outdoor workouts. There are at least three important health benefits to cold weather workouts. Number one, the body works harder in cold weather. Health experts at the Medical University of South Carolina say the body must make extra energy to keep warm in low temperatures. This means the body is burning more calories and fat. Your lungs may also work better in cold weather. Researchers at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff found some interesting results in a study of goats. Yes, I said goats, but still, their results were pretty interesting. The scientists looked at how cold weather activity affected goats. They found that during the three coldest months, the sedentary but cold-exposed goats experienced a 34% increase in maximal oxygen uptake and a 29% increase in running speed. When temperatures increased in the spring, both oxygen uptake and running speed of the goats decreased. Number two. Regular cold weather exercising may help the immune system. The winter season is also cold and flu season. Making outdoor exercise a usual part of your workout may help you avoid both colds and the flu. It may strengthen your body's defense system. The Mayo Foundation for Medical Education and Research found that winter workouts can cut your risk of getting the flu by 20 to 30%. Number three, exercising outdoors in cold weather may help your mental health. Some people who suffer from winter blues or seasonal affective disorder may benefit from going outside to exercise in the fresh air and sunshine. An outdoor workout increases exposure to sunlight. Sunlight helps the body produce vitamin D, and vitamin D produces hormones that brighten your mood. So there are several health benefits of exercising outdoors in very cold weather. But there are also dangers. Frostbite is one of the most common. Edward Ward is a doctor at Rush University Medical Center. He explains how frostbite happens.
When the air temperature drops below zero, especially factoring in wind chill, things freeze. And that includes the fluids that's within your fingers, your toes, nose, ears. You know, anything that's exposed to that wind chill can be affected by frostbite.
Protecting your fingers, toes, ears, and nose is very important. Cold winds affect these parts of the body more quickly than other parts. Christopher Sampson is a doctor with University of Missouri Healthcare. He explains that frostbite can happen rapidly in less than 30 minutes.
With frostbite, people can start experiencing symptoms pretty rapidly. On average, with mild winds and cold temperatures, it can occur in as less as than 30 minutes. With extreme cases, when it's very, very cold and winds are very, very strong, sometimes frostbite can develop in as little as 5 minutes.
The beginning of frostbite is called frost nip. Experts at the Mayo Clinic explain that with this mild form of frostbite, your skin pales or turns red and feels very cold. Continued exposure leads to prickling and numbness in the affected area. As your skin warms, you may feel pain and tingling. Frost nip doesn't permanently damage the skin, but frostbite can. It can even lead to loss of tissue and limbs. The most serious danger is hypothermia. Hypothermia is when the body temperature has fallen below 35 degrees Celsius, or about 95 degrees Fahrenheit. This happens when your body cannot produce enough energy to keep the body warm enough. Hypothermia can kill you. There are several signs to watch for before it's too late. Difficulty in movement. Difficulty in thinking. Slowed reactions. Unclear speech. Cold feet and hands. Shivering. Sleepiness. However, Dr. Sampson says it is ice that creates the biggest risk for workouts outside when it is very cold. People don't see the ice, step on it, and fall. But if you are dressed right, you can exercise safely in low temperatures. Experts on several health websites say it is important to dress in layers. The layer closest to the body should be made of a material that takes moisture away from the body. The next layer should be a material that traps heat, such as wool. And finally, the outer layer should be water resistant. Of course, don't forget gloves, hat, good socks, and shoes. When it is really cold, a scarf or face mask will protect your skin and lungs. Temperature is not the only thing that will affect your outdoor workout. It is also important to consider wind and water. Wind can go through your clothing and steal the layer of warm air that surrounds your body. If you get wet, you may not be able to keep your body temperature high enough. So, if you are a generally healthy person, do not think you must move your workouts indoors in winter. As long as you dress properly, drink enough water, and exercise safely, you can get a lot out of a cold weather workout. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
From
VOA Learning English. Welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. The old Republican Party of Thomas Jefferson had split into two opposing groups. President John Quincy Adams led one of the groups. It called itself the National Republican Party. Andrew Jackson, a military hero and politician, led the other group. It called itself the Democratic Party. Each party had its own newspapers. In Washington, the Daily National Journal supported President Adams. The United States Telegraph supported General Jackson. The Telegraph published accusations by Democrats in Congress against the administration. The Journal, in turn, published a pamphlet that said Jackson had fought a man, chased him away like a dog, and then stolen his wife. Jackson denied these claims. Historians still do not know how much of this story is true, but the story had a great effect on Jackson for the rest of his life. Jackson met the young woman, Rachel, at her mother's home near Nashville, Tennessee. Rachel and her husband, Louis Robards, were living there at the time. They were having marriage problems. Robards argued with his wife about Jackson. He said she and Jackson seemed too close. Robards reportedly wanted to fight Jackson with his fists. Jackson said he would face Robards not in a fist fight, but in a gunfight if Robards wished to fight like a gentleman. Robards rejected the invitation to a duel, and nothing more happened between the two men. Robards and his wife settled their differences, but a short time later, they had another dispute, and Rachel left. Court records said she left with a man, Andrew Jackson. Rachel's family said she told Robards she wanted a divorce. They said he threatened her, telling her he would carry her away by force. So Rachel's family said she decided to flee. She decided to go with some traders to Natchez in the dangerous Mississippi Territory. By now, Rachel meant a great deal to Andrew Jackson. He had fallen in love with her. When the traders asked him to go with them to Natchez to protect them, he agreed. The group left for the territory early in 1791. For his part, Louis Robards began preparations for a divorce. He allowed Rachel's family to believe that he and Rachel were no longer married. But in fact, he did not complete the necessary legal action to make the divorce final. Jackson returned from Natchez after several months. His opponents later claimed that he had married Rachel while in Natchez. They said she was still another man's wife at the time. Opponents said the couple's relationship was both immoral and illegal. They said Jackson was an adulterer for having a relationship with a married woman. And they said Rachel was a bigamist for having two husbands. But Jackson said he believed Rachel and her first husband, Louis Robards, were divorced. He said he returned to Nashville to ask Rachel's mother for permission to marry her daughter and that she agreed. Andrew and Rachel Jackson remained in Tennessee. The next 2 years were busy for Jackson. As a young lawyer, he worked hard and traveled far. Then in December 1793, Jackson said he discovered court papers showing that Louis Robards had only recently divorced Rachel. Jackson said he was shocked. As soon as possible, He and Rachel were married again, legally this time. Almost 10 years passed. Jackson became a judge and got involved in Tennessee politics. But the circumstances of his marriage remained an issue that led to arguments. For instance, a man once accused Jackson of cheating on a horse racing bet. Then the man called his wife a bigamist. Jackson killed the man in a duel. Later, in the 1828 presidential election, Jackson's opponents made Rachel's honor a campaign issue. Jackson could not duel everyone who questioned his wife's honor, so he asked a special committee of citizens to investigate his marriage and make a public report. Many people on the committee were his friends or supporters. The committee found that the Jacksons were not at fault for getting married before Rachel and her first husband were legally divorced. The pro-Jackson newspaper in Washington published the committee's report. Pro-Jackson papers also began to print vicious stories about President Adams and his wife. Anti-Jackson newspapers did not publish the committee's report. They continued to denounce the Jacksons' marriage. Historian Daniel Feller at the University of Tennessee is an expert on Andrew Jackson. He says the charges about Jackson's marriage made a good story for people to talk about, but he says other accusations were more serious. These were about Jackson's career.
The attacks that really hit home were about Jackson's unauthorized and perhaps directly against orders conquest of Florida in 1819, his sometimes savage disciplinary measures against his own troops, his declaring martial law in New Orleans and maintaining martial law in New Orleans and arresting people in New Orleans well after the War of 1812 was actually over.
All during the bitter election campaign, neither Jackson nor his opponent, President Adams, said anything about one very important issue, slavery. Adams did not want to lose what little support he had in the South and West by denouncing slavery. Jackson did not want to lose the support of some Republicans in the North by openly defending it. Adams's silence did not mean that he approved of slavery. Southerners were sure that he opposed it, and Jackson did not have to tell the South what he thought about slavery. He was a slave owner, and he had bought and sold slaves all his life. There was another important difference between the two men and their political parties. President Adams and the Republicans represented the interests of those who owned property. Many of the president's supporters felt that wealthy, property-owning citizens should control the government. Jackson and the Democrats represented the interests of the common people. They did not feel that the rich had more right to govern than the poor. The presidential election of 1828 was held on different days in the different states between October 31st and November 5th. Voters in the northern states supported John Quincy Adams. Andrew Jackson won the South. Historian Daniel Feller says Southerners did not seem bothered by opponents' fears that Jackson was mentally unstable and believed he should have unlimited power.
They were much more compelled by the image of this great man of the people and also this great man on horseback, the hero of New Orleans.
Even President Adams recognized that Jackson was extremely well-liked.
John Quincy Adams wrote in his diary years before the election that In a popularity contest, in a political contest, no man could stand against the hero of New Orleans.
When the electoral votes were counted, Andrew Jackson received 178. President Adams received only 83. Rachel Jackson was proud of her husband, but she was not happy about the life she would have to lead as First Lady, and her health seemed to be suffering. For Mr. Jackson's sake, she said, I am glad. For my own part, I never wished it. Nevertheless, the couple prepared to move to Washington. There was little time for Rachel to rest. Then, just a few days before the Jacksons were to move, two doctors were called to the Jackson home. They found Rachel in great pain. She seemed to be having a heart attack. After a day or so, she appeared to be better. She was able to sit up and talk with friends, but her mind was still troubled about the years ahead in Washington. I had rather be a doorkeeper in the house of God, she said, than to dwell in that palace in Washington. She was referring to the presidential mansion, later known as the White House. In December of 1828, a few nights before Christmas, Rachel was sitting in a chair. Her husband had already gone to sleep. Suddenly, Rachel cried out and fell to the floor. The servants screamed. Jackson ran to the room, picked Rachel up, and carried her to the bed. But he could see that life had already left her. Witnesses said Jackson continued to sit next to her, holding his head in his hands. Rachel was buried 2 days later. 10,000 people went to the funeral. The Reverend William Hume spoke of Rachel Jackson's life. He talked of her kindness and humility, and he told how she had been upset about the personal accusations against her during the election campaign. Jackson believed those accusations were a cause of Rachel's death. His anger is expressed on the stone above Rachel's grave. One line of the inscription says, "A being so gentle and so virtuous, slander might wound, but could not dishonor." At that time, Andrew Jackson was 61 years old. He was a tall, thin man. His long face was wrinkled. Most portraits of him show a great mass of messy hair pushed back from his high forehead. Jackson's health had never really been good. He carried in his body two bullets from duels fought years before. But he was a tough man, with a spirit strong enough to keep moving, even when he was grieving. He left for Washington in January 1829. A huge crowd was gathering there to meet him. They would create one of the wildest inaugural celebrations in American history. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.